From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, singer Emmylou Harris. After years of interpreting other people's songs, she has a new solo CD on which she wrote all but one of the selections. We'll talk with her about writing songs and hear some of them as well. Her new CD is Red Dirt Girl. Also, Knowing When to Hold Back. A talk with horror writer Peter Straub about maintaining suspense in a story and about the event in his life that helped make him a horror writer. He has a new collection of short fiction. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. Stormy seas are frustrating efforts to rescue 116 Russian sailors trapped in a crippled nuclear sub at the bottom of the Barents Sea. The Russian Navy chief says the situation is extremely grave, that water may be leaking into the sub while it's running out of oxygen. There's been no communication with the Kursk since the accident during the weekend. Rescuers are trying to lower an escape capsule to the submarine, but so far have been unable to make contact with the vessel. It was 40 years ago that John F. Kennedy accepted the Democratic presidential nomination in Los Angeles. And tonight, it's Kennedy night at the Democratic convention, with speeches from three members of the Kennedy family. From member station KPCC, Kitty Feldy reports.
Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg usually shuns the spotlight, but as the sole living child of John F. Kennedy, she agreed to address the Democratic National Convention. Cousin Patrick Kennedy, a congressman from Rhode Island who gives his own convention speech earlier in the session, says she'll be great.
Caroline is a very poised, eloquent speaker who I'm sure is going to impress everyone with her delivery and what she'll have to say.
The congressman's father, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy, follows Schlossberg to the podium, and then he's followed by the man who ran against Al Gore in the primary, Bill Bradley. For NPR News, I'm Kitty Feldy from the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles.
Gore accepts the nomination Thursday night. Today, he campaigned with President Clinton in Michigan, a state the Democrats won in the last two elections. The president urged voters to stick with the Democrats.
I think the record is clear. This country is better off than it was 8 years ago.
Mr. Clinton said that Al Gore was at the heart of every achievement of his administration. 3 weeks after an Air France Concorde crash killed 113 people near Paris, British Airways is grounding its supersonic fleet. British and French aviation officials are expected to revoke the jet's airworthiness certification. Paul Chapman reports from London.
British Airways' fleet of seven Concordes is out of action indefinitely, 3 weeks after the Air France crash that claimed 113 lives. Air accident investigators who recommended the withdrawal of the aircraft's safety certificate are expected to reveal later what led to the decision. The Air France crash is thought to have been caused by fuel line fractures from a tire burst by runway debris. But the move to ground all Concordes suggests the experts have made a further discovery, which casts doubt on the safety of all such aircraft. Industry observers say they're baffled by the measure because British Airways has continued to fly its Concorde fleet with few problems. For NPR News, I'm Paul Chapman in London.
On Wall Street today, the market was mixed. The Dow closed down 109 points in light trading. The Nasdaq was up 2 points. This is NPR News. Massachusetts health officials said today that the West Nile virus has been detected in mosquitoes in their state for the first time. The virus is carried by birds but transmitted to humans by mosquitoes. So far this summer, there have been only 3 human cases, all non-fatal and all in Staten Island, New York. The worst wildfire season in 50 years has led to shortages of firefighters and equipment in many areas in the West. Fire managers are having to let some fires in remote areas burn. Jackie Yamanaka of Yellowstone Public Radio reports.
There are so many fires burning across the West that fire managers are finding they're having to prioritize their resources. J.D. Coleman is a fire spokesman for the Northern Region Coordinating Center in Missoula. He says they're trying to move quickly to snuff out any new fire sparked across Montana and Idaho, especially when they're close to where people live.
The exception to that rule is in areas, remote areas, where you don't want to waste a resource report a fire that you can monitor, and it won't hurt if it burns.
So Coleman says fire managers are closely monitoring these remote fires to make sure they don't spread beyond the wilderness boundaries. For NPR News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
The Justice Department today urged the Supreme Court to quickly hear Microsoft's appeal of a ruling that the software giant should be divided into two companies. Justice Department lawyers had brought the antitrust case against Microsoft and won, and today asked the High Court to hear Microsoft's appeal right away, rather than for the case to be heard first by a federal appeals court. The Supreme Court has agreed to this fast-track appeal process only twice since 1974. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. My guest is Emmy Lou Harris. While most people think of Harris as a country singer, her 30-year career has spanned country, folk, and pop music. A 9-time Grammy Award winner, Harris is known for her distinctive interpretations of others' music, as well as her skill as a harmonizer. Harris began her career singing harmony with the late Gram Parsons, the flamboyant member of the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers. She went on to a distinguished solo career and has also sung with many country and rock stars, including Bob Dylan, Bonnie Raitt, Bruce Springsteen, Roy Orbison, Neil Young, also Dolly Parton and Linda Ronstadt, with whom Harris recorded two albums, Trio and Trio 2. Her new CD, Red Dirt Girl, is Harris's first solo album in 5 years, since her groundbreaking CD, Wrecking Ball, with Daniel Lanois. It's only the second time she's written her own material. All but one of the songs are hers. Here's the title track from the new album, Red Dirt Girl.
Emmy Lou Harris, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I love this show.
Now, you first played guitar as a teenager. This is in the 60s, mid-60s. Whose songs did you play, and who are you fashioning yourself after? Did you want to be Joan Baez?
Oh, yes. We all wanted to be Joan Baez. When those records came out and that voice that was so pure and so beautiful combined with those incredibly haunting child ballads, about, you know, just, you know, the great Silky and and Barbara Allen and those wonderful songs that have those gorgeous melodies that somehow have this primal quality. And Bob Dylan, who just made language and poetry explode for me and for, I think, everyone of my generation. I discovered folk blues also, but I also discovered very quickly that I couldn't play slide guitar So it was a great shock to me when I thought it was a girl thing. So it was a great shock to me when I saw Bonnie Raitt at the Philadelphia Folk Festival. And I went, wait a minute. She's not supposed to be able to do that. But, you know, Booker White and Sunhouse and Robert Johnson and Mississippi Fred McDowell and all those, that great wealth of folk blues. I loved Ian and Sylvia, Tom Rush. I mean, there was just so much great inventive music. The real stuff, you know, the real traditional stuff. The music of the Carter family, but then artists like Bob Dylan and who were writing these wonderful songs and drawing on the traditions of Woody Guthrie, but bringing it forward, you know, bringing it into the poetry of a new generation.
Well, after college, you went to New York City, lived in Greenwich Village. What was your grand plan?
To be Joan Baez. well, I had a kind of a side trip into Virginia Beach. I quit school and went to Virginia Beach on the excuse that I was going to earn money to go to a proper drama school because I still was thinking that I wanted to be an actress. But most of my time was spent learning songs and playing songs. And I divided my time in Virginia Beach between waitressing and singing in the clubs at night. There was quite a nice little folk scene there. And but after I tried my hand at a few summer classes, drama classes, attached to Boston University where I had gotten, I'd auditioned and gotten in, I realized that my true love was music. And so I headed to New York City, where I assumed there was this flourishing folk scene, but sort of the psychedelic movement had kind of moved in and shoved a lot of the folk scene out that I imagined was there. So I went back to the other thing that I knew how to do, which was waiting tables. And I got kind of sidetracked. I got married, and I had a baby, and pretty much given up the idea of being an artist, of being a singer. Just didn't seem to be in the cards. But when I found that I had to make a living, I had a child to support. At that point, I'd found myself being a single parent. And though I had a lot of help from my parents, I did have to bring in some money. And discovered to my delight in Washington, D.C., where I had moved to be near my parents, that there was a really nice music scene there. And that's where I met the Seldom Seen, people like John Starling and John Duffy, Bill and Taffy Danoff, who were Fat City at that time and went on to become the Starland Vocal Band. And I fell in with a really nice, supportive group of musicians. And it was while I was playing those clubs, a different club every night, six, seven nights a week, sometimes four shows a night, that I stumbled into the path of Gram Parsons.
Now, Gram Parsons, who's known from his work with the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers, you credit him as your great inspiration, at least in the beginning of your career. It took about a year since meeting Gram Parsons before you actually got into a studio in L.A. with him to record his first solo album, GP. What was he like in recording sessions? He's known for his partying, certainly. Did he
drink?
Well,
the first album, I just thought, I can't believe that this is how people make records. It seems so disorganized. Now, he had a very professional group of musicians, which a lot of them who went on to become my hot band and that I recorded with, Glenn D. Harden and James Burton. He had Ronnie Tutt there on drums. Herb Peterson was there. And Al Perkins on pedal steel. But Gram was drinking, and it seemed very disorganized. Barry Tashin was there, and I sort of gleaned onto Barry. Barry seemed to be a little more together. And I just didn't know what was going on. But in spite of it all, you couldn't help but really like Gram. He was so generous, and he was funny, and he was somebody that you just wanted to take care of. You just knew that he was a good old boy. You know, he was just a good soul. And, but the whole experience, I mean, I left there thinking, well, I can't believe that there's going to be a record. But I was very surprised when I heard the record, and I thought it was great, and I got the call to go on tour. And during the course of putting together that tour and actually touring, Graham seemed to really gather strength and really seemed to be pulling himself together. And he was really making a conscious effort to stop drinking and was really getting whole and strong. And we were doing so much singing, and we were so excited about the prospect of the next record. I guess that's why his death shocked me, because it seemed like he was out of the woods. You know, I was very naive about those things.
How did singing with Graham Parsons on that tour and also on his two records influence your development of your own voice, your own style?
Oh, it had everything to do with my development as a singer. I mean, I had a pretty voice. I sang a lot of different types of songs adequately and maybe sometimes well. But there was something about, first of all, singing harmony, which required a certain discipline, and second of all, singing country music, which has an inherent restraint and economy of emotion in the singing and in the phrasing. And coupled with the fact that my voice is not a traditional sounding country voice like Loretta Lynn or a Tammy Wynette or even a more contemporary singer like, let's say, Tanya Tucker, it I think gave it a different sound. It occupied, it found its own place. It found its, my voice found its own voice, its own footing. And it kind of happened by osmosis. It wasn't a conscious thing.
Emmylou Harris is my guest. Her career has spanned country, folk, pop, alternative music. She's a winner of 9 Grammys. Her new album is Red Dirt Girl. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Sorrow is constant, and the joys are brief. The seasons come.
We're back with Emmylou Harris. Her new album is Red Dirt Girl. It's her first solo album in 5 years. She wrote all but one of the songs on the new album. I'd like to listen to one of the most well-known songs of the songs that you collaborated on with Graham Parsons, and that's Love Hurts. It's from his last solo album, Grievous Angel. Before we play it, could you talk about it a little? Is it a song that you did a lot of work on while you were with him on the road?
Oh, yeah. That was a song that I guess we started singing either on the bus or in a dressing room or at some point, because we had already recorded the first album. And after we got on the road, that was when we really started singing stuff all the time. And Graham was an encyclopedia of songs. He knew every Everly Brothers song ever recorded, and some very obscure ones. And I think Love Hurts had never been a single. It was probably a B-side. And so that song very quickly found its way into our show, even though we had not recorded it. Because we only had it. When we first started out on the tour, we had so few songs that when we finally got an encore, we had to go back and start singing the set again. So we actually had a rehearsal, and we had to work up some more songs. And Love Hurts just became a real peak of the show. So the song was sort of fully formed by the time we got into the studio, and it was just a matter of doing, singing it on. We had two microphones right together, and we sang, which is the way we sang on stage. And we just sang it as the track went down, just like we would do it, you know, on stage.
Let's listen. This is Graham Parsons with my guest Emmylou Harris. The song is Love Hurts from Graham Parsons' 1973 album, Grievous Angel. That was Graham Parsons' Love Hurts with my guest Emmylou Harris from the 1973 recording Grievous Angel. Graham Parsons died just about a month after this album was recorded. His death was attributed to an overdose from a whole mix of drugs and alcohol. You had planned to put a band together with Graham and go on the road again. And I imagine suddenly without this huge supporter and presence in your life, how did you see yourself? Did you see yourself as a solo musician after Parsons died?
No, I didn't. I thought I have got this great job. You know, I want to sing with Graham. I loved the non-pressure of being up there as a, you know, acoustic guitar player and harmony singer, occasionally doing a solo song because Graham was very, very generous. You know, and he was always polishing everybody else's diamond, you know. He wanted everybody to shine. And so it was kind of perfect. And I also still considered myself an apprentice. I felt I had so much to learn from him and from the music that we were doing that I had only recently sort of found my voice, and I still had a long way to go. So, of course, it was very devastating, and I just did not know what to do. And I was thinking, well, I'm just going to go ahead and move to Los Angeles without any plans at all. I really didn't know what I was going to do. And a very good friend of mine, John Starling, just sat me down and he said, listen, he said, you need to stay in Washington. He said, you have friends here, you have family here, and you need to work on your music here and figure out who you are and what you're going to do. Because I knew that I couldn't go back to being a folk singer. I had become, you know, completely entranced with the drummer. You know, before that, as a folk singer, I thought the drummer was the Antichrist, you know, and you just didn't work with the drummer if you were a folk singer. And I had to learn how to front a band. And so I just put a little band together from the good local musicians there in Washington. Another thing that John had said to me was, you have a relationship with the clubs in this town, and you have an audience. You know, people know you here as a local artist. So I went back to the clubs that I had played as a folk singer. I went back with a small country band, had a drummer, bass player, pedal steel player, electric guitar player, and myself, and we called ourselves Angel Band after the Stanley Brothers song. You know, we just started playing, and I got a record deal with Reprise, and we went in and made the first record.
I think a lot of people say that their favorite Emmylou Harris album is Blue Kentucky Girl. Apparently, it wasn't a big hit with your record company when you decided to do it. They didn't know what to do with it. What was their problem?
Well, it was very straightforward country comparatively. All the other albums up to that point had been very eclectic. There had been country music, very traditional country music on it, but done with a slight twist. You know, like Hello Stranger being a very traditional Carter Family song, but done with drums and bass, mandolin, and electric guitar. than If I Could Only Win Your Love, done very traditionally. But then you had, you know, Beatles songs like For No One and Here, There, and Everywhere, a Chuck Berry cover, songs by new writers that people hadn't heard of before, like Rodney Crowell. So it was very eclectic. And there was this sort of truth going around, sort of a fact, people accepting the fact that, well, sure, she's crossover country, but she's not really country because she doesn't do pure country. And I kind of resented that, but I knew they were right, that there was a possibility. So I did Blue Kentucky Girl for a couple of reasons. I think, first of all, for those reasons, I wanted to prove to myself that I could make a record that, in the words of Waylon Jennings, couldn't go pop with a mouthful of firecrackers. And also, because I had been spending a lot of time with Ricky Skaggs, who had just joined my band, and also Sharon and Cheryl White, who were doing some touring with me. So a lot of the music we were making on the back of the bus and hanging around in dressing rooms was more and more kind of traditional, less left field, as it were. And because that was sort of what was happening musically, so it seemed like, well, that's the record that we should do. But it was also to make a point that we were going to take more of the traditional country elements and make an album that was perhaps a little purer and more truer to form than the other previous four albums.
Emmy Lou Harris's new CD is Red Dirt Girl. She'll be back in the second half of our show. Let's listen to a song from her 1979 recording, Blue Kentucky Girl. This is Sorrow in the Wind. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
I hear the soft wind sighing in every bush and tree. The sound of my heart crying when you are far from me. When we're apart, my darling, there's sorrow in the wind. When we're apart, my darling, sweet sorrow.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air, and from Learning Network, providing online learning tools and development programs for teachers, parents, and students on the web at learningnetwork.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Terror, Nightmares, and the Lurking Past, a talk with horror writer Peter Straub. He has a new collection of short fiction and is currently working in collaboration with Stephen King on the sequel to their book, The Talisman. And we continue our conversation with Emmy Lou Harris. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue now with our interview with Emmylou Harris. Harris is a 9-time Grammy Award-winning musician who's known for her interpretations of country, bluegrass, folk, and pop music. She's credited with helping to make country music hip. In over 30 years recording and touring, Harris has sung with major stars in country and rock, including Graham Parsons, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, the McGarrigle Sisters, Willie Nelson, Dolly Parton, and Linda Ronstadt. Her new album, Red Dirt Girl, is her first solo recording in 5 years. It's inspired in part by her CD Wrecking Ball, Harris's foray into contemporary folk. Wrecking Ball, which came out in 1995 and was produced by Daniel Lanois, didn't really sound like anything else you'd done before. Daniel Lanois is known for having produced Peter Gabriel and U2, among other bands. And he has a way of creating an eerie gothic quality to the work that he writes and produces. What was it like to work with him? What was your process bringing that album Wrecking Ball together?
Well, the thing is, I was such a fan of his work. Actually, I know that he had done that work with those people, and it was wonderful. But the thing that really made me sit up and take notice was his own solo record, Acadie, the first one, and then the album he did with Dylan. The first album he did with Dylan, Oh Mercy, which I discovered around the same time. And you're right about the quality he brings to a lot of his work, but there's something very close to the bone and traditional and yet very spooky about those two records, his solo record and Oh Mercy. And I didn't find it that much of a stretch of things that I had done in the past or wanted to do, because I love that left field sound. I like the combination of real acoustic sounds and real raw sounds with all the things that you can do technologically with amps and guitar sounds and things like that. So I was intrigued with what he could do with the different unusual songs I might come up with, and my voice.
Let's play a cut from Wrecking Ball. Emmylou, do you have a song that you like most from the album?
Oh, gosh. Well, I like everything on there, but...
I have to say I love the Daniel Lanois songs, Where Will I Be, or also
Black Hawk. Oh, well, let's do Where Will I Be, because maybe we need something a little up-tempo. It's kind of hard for me to find those up-tempo songs.
Good. Let's play Where Will I Be. This is Emmylou Harris from her 1995 album, Wrecking Ball.
All the streets are crammed, and there's glass everywhere. And a baby stares out with motherless son.
My guest, Emmylou Harris, singing Where Will I Be from her album Wrecking Ball. I really love your voice in this album. It sounds as if you're less carefully articulating the lyrics, and that gives it this, for me at least, this more dreamlike and stream of consciousness sound. Did working with Daniel Lanois influence how you sang on this album?
Well, I think it was the process of it, so yes. I mean, I've been moving toward live vocals, and... Daniel was very much into that. In fact, I found out after the fact that he and Malcolm Byrne had made the decision that whatever take we ended up with was going to be determined by the live vocal. If there was a really good live vocal, then that was going to be the take, warts and all, which I was really glad I didn't know about that. Because basically all I did was sit there in a studio where everybody was in the room, where there was very little separation, and it was a small band of people, and I just sang, and I love to sing songs a lot. I'm very happy to do 20, 30 takes of a song if I have to. I like to sing it when the band is learning it. The more I sing it, the more comfortable I feel with it. I don't worry about peaking, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
So what we got was live vocals with all the molecules and the sounds swirling around in the room, bleeding into the microphone, but in a very professional way. I mean, there was method to this madness. You know, he knew exactly what he was doing. But I think that probably added a lot to what you're talking about that comes across on this record.
Well, you live in Nashville now. Do you listen to country radio?
Well, actually, I don't. I don't listen to country radio. The few times I'm someplace where it's on, or you know, the video station is on, I find it to be a bit of a one-note kind of a thing. I can't really tell the difference between one singer and the next, one song and the next, one bit of production and the next. You know, it takes a lot for my attention to be drawn in by an artist or a piece of music, I will admit that. But I don't think I'm wrong in saying that it seems to me that we're dealing with a whole lot of Big Macs out there and not a whole lot of choice.
I'd like to ask you about singing with other people. You've sung duets with just, the list is too long to mention, but just the greats of folk and rock and country. You've put out two albums with Dolly Parton and Linda Ronstadt. You've also done a duets album that features Roy Orbison, George Jones, Neil Young. You've sung with Bob Dylan. Does each artist have idiosyncrasies that you have to adapt to singing harmony with them?
Oh, yes. That's what makes it work. I mean, the fact that every artist is unique, not only in the way they phrase, which, of course, is a big part of singing with them. It's like dancing with somebody. Not that I can dance with somebody, but I imagine that that's what it must be like because you have to follow them, but you also have to be completely comfortable and be yourself. the way they pronounce certain words so that, you know, this note has to buzz with them. But for the most part, if you think about those things, I can't think when I sing. I just have to jump in and just hope that I'm going to get it.
Emmy Lou Harris, it's been such a pleasure talking with you on Fresh Air. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Emmy Lou Harris. Her new CD is Red Dirt Girl. She's currently on an international tour. Here's Emmy Lou Harris singing with Dolly Parton and Linda Ronstadt. The song is The Pain of Loving You. Coming up, writing horror for literature lovers. This is Fresh Air. Peter Straub has been called the thinking man Stephen King. He's known for his horror novels, but in his 14 books, he's also wandered into the mystery, suspense, fantasy, gothic, and science fiction genres. Most of these literary styles are represented in Straub's new collection of stories, Magic Terror. His other books include Mr. X, Ghost Story, The Hellfire Club, and The Talisman, which he collaborated on with Stephen King in 1984. He and King are currently working on a sequel. Straub says that he became a connoisseur of fear when he was 7 and was hit by a car while crossing the street. His long convalescence introduced him to what he calls fear's older brothers, terror and panic, and the rest of the family, nightmare, rage, depression, and shame, all of which he explores in his fiction. Straub has said that horror is an essential, crucial part of human existence, with its own considerable beauty. I asked him if writing horror is really writing about morality, and if that's what he finds fulfilling in it.
Yes, I would say it is what I find fulfilling, because it also kind of shades off into other moral areas, which mainly have to do with awareness, specifically the awareness of what is generally rejected or denied. Someone in our society has to speak of what is generally considered unacceptable, if not unspeakable. And it is sort of a privilege to be given that role. What I'm talking about are not merely moments of physical distress, but of their emotional consequences. That is, emotions like grief and terror, loss, sorrow, pain. Stuff like that, which is of immense human consequence, is really what is the good horror writers meat and drink. If you deal simply with sensation, then you're sort of cheating. You're cheating both the subject and yourself.
As a child, you knew about scary stuff. You were in a serious car accident when you were, what was it, 7?
I was 7, that's right, alas, alas.
What happened?
I was a little boy trying to cross the street holding an ice cream cone, and I was far too concentrated on the ice cream cone, far more so than I should have been, and I never noticed the car bearing down on me until I glanced over my shoulder, or I glanced to my side, which I should have done before I stepped off the curb, and I saw this car about 15 feet away from me, and I knew that there was no way I was going to get it out of the way. Besides, I experienced that well-known response of people in abrupt peril, that of paralysis. So I literally was incapable of moving, and I just saw this thing march toward me as in a series of frames, closer, 2 feet closer, another foot closer, until finally the curtain mercifully descends. When I woke up, I was in a hospital. I was in terrible pain. Life had taken a turn for the worse, for sure. And that was a long experience. I went through what everybody goes through when something like that happens. I had operations, hospitalizations, further operations, and people telling me over and over, put this behind you, Peter. Forget about it. Unfortunately, I did manage to put it behind me and forget about it. And consequently, I had a tropism toward what other people saw as unacceptable. That is, at heart, I wanted to represent this extremely powerful experience, which had happened to me, but I had to transform it and put it into metaphorical terms, hence the birth of a horror writer.
Well, before you put it behind you, did you have nightmares about what had happened, and what were they about?
Well, I had lots and lots of grotesque nightmares, and I think they probably increased after I persuaded myself that I didn't have to remember what had happened to me, because that's what happens. You know, what do they call that? The return of the repressed. Mm-hmm. It's the return of the return of the vicious and the angry and the irrepressible, really. I had these dreams which represented the kind of reenactment of what had happened to me in symbolic terms. And that kind of experience didn't stop happening to me until I had at last figured it out and gone back and faced, this event, which I'd rather devalued and downgraded. in which, you know, to be a really fully functioning, at least more or less attached human being, I had to come to terms with.
Around this time, after you were recovering from the car accident, you started to stutter. Did that plague you as a kid?
Oh, it was terrible. Here I was, this very verbose, garrulous, nonstop talker. And all of a sudden, one day I stood up in class and I had to read a bit from the page of a textbook, at which I was really good, let me tell you. I was like, I was like a professional reader or something. And so it was this great opportunity to show off. And I came to the word Pittsburgh, and the word Pittsburgh refused to emerge. It just sat there like a stone on my tongue. And that plagued me ever since. My stutter still persists, but in a much, much smaller form. It mainly surfaces when I'm dealing with telephone operators or situations like that. It just more or less faded with age, but it was a terrible burden.
Peter, you didn't start out as a horror writer. You first wrote some poetry, wrote a novel, Marriages, about an adulterous affair. How did you discover horror?
I first became acquainted with horror when I was about 13 years old, with the purchase of a book called a modern library giant called Great Tales of Terror and the Supernatural. I was very attached to that book, and I hauled it around with me wherever I went for a couple of months. And I eventually read all the stories in it. It was a huge, huge book. Then that sort of went away. I began reading H.P. Lovecraft and people like that in the early 70s when my wife and I were living in Dublin and London. And I met a friend named Tom Tessier, who was very well versed in that sort of writing. And he encouraged me to begin reading it. And I did it, and I liked it quite a bit. Remember, this was the time when The Exorcist had just come out, when Rosemary's Baby had just made a big splash, and as had done two novels by a former actor named Tom Tryon. They were all horror novels, and they all did very, very well. It was as though horror had, for some reason or other, experienced a kind of rebirth. I wrote that first novel, Marriages, which was not very good at all. I sort of wallowed for a little while and thrashed about, unable to just, you know, decide what to do. Then I decided to try to add my own little paper boat to the, you know, horror stream. And the second I started, it was with a book called Julia. Really, almost the instant I started, in the first sentence, I felt at home. I knew right away that book was going to work. This is a very unusual experience for a young writer. And anyhow, it did work. And it worked in the best way, that is, that pieces of crucial information appeared to me just at the moment when they were needed. So the whole thing fell together. And sort of shaped itself. I knew it was publishable, and I knew it was going to do reasonably well. And thank goodness it was published, and it did do reasonably well.
So even though horror was a new branch of literature, it was just dawning on the American consciousness with The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby. Mm-hmm. It didn't have a stigma?
Oh, it did, of course, have a stigma. It was just my good luck to enter a field that was seen as low rent and sort of despicable, because in that field, where my strengths really could flourish, I could sort of put on muscle and learn my business unbothered. No critics were going to pay a lot of attention to me. The only people who were going to pay attention were readers, and readers bought those books in great numbers and appreciated what I was doing and what I was trying to do. It gave me a chance to sort of flourish unobserved, and also to have enough time to explore and the dignity that actually existed in this field, which was considered so low rent.
Peter Straub is my guest. He's best known as a horror writer. His novels include Ghost Story, The Hellfire Club, Mr. X, and The Talisman, which he collaborated on with Stephen King. His new book, Magic Terror, is a collection of short stories. Peter, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're back with horror writer Peter Straub. His new collection of short stories is Magic Terror. I'd like you to read a passage from another one of your books, Mr. X, which it's about a man who turns into a man named Ned Dunstan, and he's haunted by visions of horrors committed by some thing or person he calls Mr. X. Ned Dunstan seems to lead a kind of double life or be pursued by a kind of doppelganger. And he gradually finds out that Mr. X is part of his past. I'd like you to read this passage. Maybe you could set it up for us.
Sure. This is a part of the memoirs of the villain, Mr. X, who's recounting a very, very exciting event that happened to him in his last year at military school, where he had a perfectly good time. He has been accused of being mentally disturbed by a Captain Squadron at the school. And Captain Squadron, with fatal consequences, wants to take his sacred book from him. The sacred book is The Dunwich Horror by H.P. Lovecraft. Under the threat of this loss, Mr. X experiences an odd surge of suprapsychic ability as follows. I had no idea of what I was going to do. I certainly had no idea of what I was going to do to Captain Squadron. In fact, I still don't really know how I did it, since duplication of the feat has resisted me ever since. I don't suppose any of those mothers ever picked up a car a second time either. I touched the book, and as if I had done this kind of thing 100 times before, felt myself flow into his mind and voicelessly command its surrender. With the book safely returned to my hands, I used the same instinctive power to impel him toward the center of the room. The interior of Squadron's mind reported a sensation akin to that of being blown backward by a great wind. Captain Squadron remained incapable of speech as I withdrew from his mind. An enormous battery deep within me thrummed into life. At that moment, a certain crucial revelation that was to shape all the rest of my life came to me. I say came to me, meaning that it entered me like a clear silver stream and gave momentary form to the uproar. Once again, I had heard the voice from Johnson's Woods. Captain Squadron stood in the center of my room, perhaps 2 yards away from me. I glided toward him as if across an icy pond on a pair of figure skates. I don't think I touched him. I recall that almost impersonal sensation of emptying that accompanies evacuation. My joints suffered the bone-deep ache associated with arthritis. My head seemed to have been split by an axe. Maybe the mommies who hoist those automobiles off their babies feel the same way. I don't know. What I do know is the Captain Squadron had vanished from the room. A greenish puddle about 4 inches in diameter lay on the floor, and a wet, deathly stink hung in the air. I overcame my agonies long enough to wipe up the captain's remains with a towel, washed it off in the sink, and fell on the cot to dwell on my revelation.
Now, an interesting thing about Mr. X, he believes the horror fiction he's read. Yes. He's read this H.P. Lovecraft. He thinks those books aren't fiction. And that
he
comes up with
real.
With another one of your villains, Dick Dart in the Hellfire Club. And he's another murdering psychopath who's a huge devotee of a children's fantasy novel.
That's right.
This is a book you made up. This isn't a real book.
That's right.
But it made me wonder whether you wonder about your fans or fans in general of horror fiction. If anyone needs something to hook their insanity on or their obsessiveness, I would think horror fiction would make an easy target.
Well, it could be. But do you know what is the favorite book of all American assassins? The one they're always carrying, one and all, they're all carrying a copy of Catcher in the Rye. For some reason, that novel speaks to psychopaths like none other. And, of course, it's a very sweet, tender little object. It is possible, of course, to imagine Zany's fascinating on a fantasy novel due to its kind of world-altering or world-evading qualities. And it was just sort of fun for me to imagine a set of people who had so adopted a fantasy novel called Night Journey that they virtually recreated it and went around using the names of the characters, recreated the environments of the novel in their own apartments, and sort of disappeared into the world created in that book. I'm not sure why this idea appeals to me. It's disturbing and funny. Maybe that's why. It sounds as though I'm speaking of the dangers of imagination, but I'm about the last person in the world who would ever, allude to the dangers of imagination, because I think imagination is a primally creative, almost sacred force.
Peter Straub, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Barbara. It was great fun.
Peter Straub's new book is Magic Terror. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the making of the classic 1952 Western, Shane. We talk with George Stevens, Jr. His father directed the film. It's just been reissued on DVD. Also, corporate branding and the protest movement it's inspired. A talk with Naomi Klein, author of No Logo. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.